Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning. It's The Show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, how the state's trucking industry is responding to new federal rules on English proficiency and why a pro marathoner went indoors to train to run in high humidity. But first, Scottsdale Mayor Lisa Borowski will be hosting a town hall tonight. An announcement for the event says it will, quote, set the record straight on critical issues. Borowski and her colleagues on the city council have been at odds on a number of issues over the past 10 months, including on issues over staffing and a downtown parking garage. With me to talk more about this discord in Scottsdale is KJZZ's Wayne Schutzke from the Politics Desk. Good morning, Wayne.
Good morning.
So it's a little bit surprising, I think, for a lot of folks that Mayor Borowski and members of the council are having this disagreement because, in theory, politically, they're all generally like in the same place, right?
For the most part, in Arizona, city council races are nonpartisan, but at this point in time, in this political environment, you kind of know where everyone stands. And Borowski, along with the council majority, are mostly conservative Republicans. So yeah, on the surface, it would look like they should be getting along. But as you mentioned, there's been a slew of issues since Borowski came into office that have really divided them.
So does it seem then that the disagreements are political? Are they policy-wise? Are they more personal?
I think the latter. I think it's more personal and then some policy stuff. I mean, I used to cover Scottsdale very closely, and you see in when you're covering a city that politics, maybe more than any other level, don't come into it as much. It really is policy driven. So whether it's the height of buildings in downtown Scottsdale or how many apartments are being built, those are the issues that are dividing, especially like a city council versus something like Republican versus Democrat.
Yeah. So let's talk about some of the issues. I mentioned a couple of them just a moment ago, but what are some of the biggies that are sort of dividing the mayor and members of the council with whom otherwise you would think she would be aligned?
Well, there's that parking garage you mentioned, which I believe is being funded by a bond that was approved years ago by voters and, you know, just to add more parking to downtown Scottsdale. But the area it's going, the mayor is not a big fan. They're afraid it's going to ruin some maybe like historically significant parts of downtown. And so she's been trying to put a, you know, alternative proposals on the board. But, you know, the council majority has largely blocked that. At one point earlier this year, there was accusations that she was trying to help a political donor become a consultant on the project and went so far as, you know, having the Maricopa County attorney get involved momentarily and conduct some interviews. Now, they didn't end up starting an official investigation or anything, but it just kind of shows you the level of discord. And, you know, there were some leaked tapes from those interviews where some of the council members said some not so nice things about the mayor. And these are council members, again, who are members of her same party, but obviously don't get along with her all that well.
Well, Wayne, there was also the issue of Mayor Borowski hiring a staff member and then the council basically taking that person away from her.
Yeah. Earlier this year, again, there was, you know, the mayor generally has a certain number of staff members assigned to the office, and the council made attempts. Actually, I mean, they could have pulled, I believe, two of the positions and reassigned them to a different office. Now, I think that got resolved and she ended up having those positions returned. But yeah, again, it was just kind of the council flexing its muscle versus Borowski and indicating that there's some conflicts of personality here.
Well, it's probably worth noting how like city governments tend to work in Arizona, speaking of flexing muscle, because, you know, we're watching news coverage of the mayoral election, for example, in New York City, and mayors don't work that same way here by and large.
That's right. Yeah. In Arizona and in a lot of Western states, outside of maybe the biggies like Los Angeles, you know, we have what's called basically a weak mayor system. And they call it that because unlike a place like New York, where the mayor has broad executive authority, similar to like a governor or something, but just for the city, in Arizona and other places with weak mayor systems, the mayor's vote is really just as strong as the other council members. They have a few other authorities like kind of presiding over meetings and deciding agendas for those meetings and things like that. But other than that, the mayor position is largely ceremonial and they're kind of just as strong as the other council members when it comes to actually voting.
So how does the climate on the current Scottsdale City Council compare to those in the past, maybe even those that you covered when you were covering Scottsdale?
Yeah, I mean, having split and divided city councils isn't unusual. I mean, the previous mayor, Dave Ortega, often sparred with members of council during his single term in office. And then even Mayor Jim Lane, who had three terms in office, often kind of presided over a 4-3 split. The difference was, is the mayor was on the winning side of that 4-3 split, Mayor Jim Lane, back in the day. So he often got many votes go his way, versus where we're seeing with Borowski, she's often ending up on the losing end. So the divide isn't necessarily surprising or new. It's just the side the mayor's landing on it, I guess, is a bit unique.
Does it seem as though all of this discontent is impacting city operations, the way that Scottsdale is being run?
Oh, without a doubt. I mean, there's that issue with staffing we talked about earlier, but also something like Axon, which, you know, listeners are probably familiar with. You've got one of the biggest homegrown companies in the city trying to build its headquarters, and now you have the council kind of getting wishy-washy on whether they're going to sue over a state law that allowed them to build that headquarters. And the only reason that law was even pursued by Axon and some lawmakers was because the council, you know, had initially approved the development, and then some members of the new council supported an effort to, you know, send it to voters. So it's just like when your biggest, one of your biggest employers and homegrown success stories can't get their headquarters built, I think that's an indication of kind of where the city council is at.
Interesting. All right. That is KJZZ's Wayne Schutzke with the Politics Desk. Wayne, good as always to talk to you. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
A recent ruling from the state Supreme Court seems to extend the right to self-defense in Arizona. The case stems from an altercation inside a condo a man shared with a woman. The woman had invited over a neighbor with whom the male resident had had disagreements. When the neighbor arrived, the man who lived in the condo locked himself inside his bedroom. But his roommate and the neighbor tried to force their way inside, and in so doing, the male resident hit the neighbor with a microphone stand. Lower courts had convicted the man of aggravated assault, but the state's high court, with one justice dissenting, vacated that conviction and ruled the man had the right to self-defense. With me to walk through the ruling and its potential implications is Brian Schwartz, associate clinical professor in the James E. Rogers College of Law at the University of Arizona. And Brian, lots of people have been talking about the Castle Doctrine in relation to this case. So let's start with sort of a thumbnail version of what exactly the Castle Doctrine is.
Yeah, it's interesting because the Castle Doctrine often kind of gets looped in with some of these self-defense laws, and they're related, I would say, but there is a distinction between the two. So the Castle Doctrine originally was in relation to our duty to retreat. So before we could act in self-defense originally, we had a duty to retreat to avoid the harmful conduct might be. And that was problematic when you think about if you're in your own home and something happens, someone's breaking in, the law required you to retreat away from that home or that place of safety, your castle. And so eventually the Castle Doctrine was created to eliminate the duty to retreat. And then what this case kind of brings out is some related defenses. So you don't have to retreat, but can you use these defenses that the case talks about to protect your home or wherever you are?
Yeah. So do you see the ruling in this case as an expansion of the Castle Doctrine?
I would say it's not an expansion of the Castle Doctrine, but it would be an expansion of our self-defense laws. So the two defense laws that it looks at is this defense of residential structure is what they're called in Arizona, and defense of premises. And even if you or, you know, listeners aren't familiar with those terms, realistically, they probably are familiar with what these self-defense laws protect. And that's if you're in your home and someone is breaking into it or unlawfully entering in some way, you have the right. The law allows you to use force to stop that intruder or person from breaking in. So what this case actually does is it reevaluates, or I guess it defines the idea of where you can claim this defense. And so residential structure is the term that Arizona uses. And the case looks at whether a locked bedroom could be a residential structure. So again, if something is a residential structure and you're inside it, you own it, you live there, and someone's trying to come in, you can use this defense. You can claim this defense, I should say, if you use force to stop them. So really what the court was looking at is, typically we think of the home just generally, but could this bedroom specifically be its own residential structure such that you could use this defense to kind of protect, to stop someone from entering that home?
Well, so it sounds like instead of maybe being an expansion of the castle doctrine, it's an expansion of the definition of residential structure.
Absolutely. And I think the court would probably say that it's not an expansion so much as they're just defining it. They believe that the room falls under the existing definition. But I think, you know, either way you look at it, I would agree with what you said. Yeah, I think we're expanding the possible places where someone could use this defense.
Well, how far do you think that would be applicable? For example, you know, would this be applicable if you were behind a locked bathroom door or if you were in your car, which is locked? Like how far do you think that the justices would say this could go?
It's hard to say for sure, of course, but I think there's a couple things to say about that. One, you mentioned the locked car. An occupied vehicle is actually part of this defense that I mentioned. So along with a residential structure, we do allow for someone who's in their vehicle and there's another individual trying to get into the vehicle. You can use this defense to stop them. So the car has actually already been considered. I think as far as like any other type of place within the home, you mentioned a bathroom, you know, any other kind of isolated room, it comes down to the definition of residential structure. And the court kind of goes through these different definitions and how to interpret it. I think realistically there's a little bit more nuance to it than what I'll say, but they're looking at, is this a place that you could live? Essentially, it has four walls, it can be secured, and it's designed to be a residence or someplace that you can live. So the extent that you would argue that a bathroom meets that, probably not. I think there's opportunity where we could see an expansion on our self-defense laws in Arizona. It's hard to tell, obviously, at this point, but I do think like this was a minor step in that direction, and there's certainly room for it to expand further.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I would imagine that there's a whole bunch of rabbit holes, legal rabbit holes, one could go down on this, right? Like, could you argue that a basement, for example, would be a residential structure? And would it matter if it was finished or not, or if it had, I don't know, if it had furniture in it or not, or a spare bedroom that maybe had or did not have other things in it versus just an empty room? Like, is it that nuanced?
It's interesting because like in law school, we always joke that the professors usually respond with like, it depends, all the questions, it depends. So there's a lot of different factual things that we could kind of play with and see. I do think that, you know, given that they're willing to extend it to a bedroom, so realistically, a place where you could imagine someone like sleeping and being for long periods of time, I do think that could probably be that could meet the definition of like you mentioned a basement. I think one of the other interesting kind of rabbit holes that this case brings up is in reality, like if someone's breaking into your house and you're up in your room, the second they enter your house, even if they then come into your room, at any point you could use force to stop them. So on the one hand, like why did we make this exception for the room specifically? And I think it brings up kind of an interesting situation. Like in this case, it had to do with an invited guest.
Right.
So you can't claim this defense that we're talking about if the person has a lawful right to enter the residential structure. And so that's really what prompted the Supreme Court to have to deal with this. We had a couple, there was a husband and wife living in a condo, and they had separate bedrooms. Their neighbor was invited over, who the husband didn't really get along with. And so the husband said, you know, I'm going to lock myself in my room, stay away from this situation, whatever's happening. And the question was, well, what if this invited guest, this neighbor, now decides that he wants to force his way into the husband's bedroom? Can the husband now claim this defense that he was using force to stop the invited guest from coming into the room? And so that's really what prompted it. I think with that in mind, that's sort of a specific factual scenario. I mean, I suppose if you have you know, a house with roommates, that might be a more, there might be this situation could arise more easily where roommates all have their own room and then there's friends over and something happens where someone's unlawfully entering a room. But that's sort of the unique twist on why we even got to this point.
All right. That is Brian Schwartz, an associate clinical professor at the James E. Rogers College of Law at the University of Arizona. Brian, thanks so much. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for having me.
Good morning. It's the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, a competition this weekend will determine the new state champions of massage. We'll hear from the Valley Massage Therapist and Hall of Famer directing the 5th Annual Massage Championship. But first, marathoner Jess McClain took home an 8th place finish at the World Athletics Championship in Tokyo last month. McClain is based in Phoenix, so the runner sponsored by Brooks has experience training in the heat. But the humidity in Tokyo in September can get as high as 80%, and training in the Valley couldn't help McClain acclimate to that. So she turned to ASU and spent time training in the Clinical Research Service's Environmental Chamber, which could simulate the heat and humidity of the Japanese capital. The chamber can mimic environments from around the world, with temperatures ranging from about 39 to 109 degrees Fahrenheit and 20 to 90% humidity. It looks like a big walk-in refrigerator and can fit a few treadmills. ASU has had it for about a year. With me to talk more about this is Ellie Iverson, a clinical exercise physiologist at ASU, and Bridget Sopenya, principal exercise physiologist at Brooks Running. And Ellie, let me start with you. Is the purpose for which Jess McClain was using the chamber kind of its main purpose?
Yeah. So in the exercise physiology world, this is a pretty common usage, I guess you could say. You can use it for metabolic testing. We used it for right heat acclimation. So just getting just kind of trained up so that when she is in Tokyo, she's able to, you know, handle that high humidity a bit better. And so you see this commonly. It's a great resource, something we were excited to one offer at ASU, but then to our community, to just to the Brooks running team. And yeah, it's cool. We do all types of research to training in it.
So, Bridget, how did you get hooked up with this? And I guess why was this maybe a better option in this case than, for example, sending the runner to train in a place that was just more humid naturally outside?
Yeah. So working with Jess earlier in the summer, when we found out that she qualified for Tokyo, we knew she lived in the heat, but we knew it was typically a drier heat. And I knew that humidity was going to be a big hurdle in Tokyo. And so I started brainstorming on ways that she could still get that humidity exposure without having to leave Arizona. Because we also don't want to add additional stress to these athletes by sending them away from their home leading up to such a big race. A very big component of athlete performance is rest and relaxation and low stress. So wanted her to be able to stay put in her home, right outside of Phoenix. And I had contacts at ASU, from my time at the Gatorade Sports Science Institute previously. So I reached out to them to see if we could connect and provide some services for Jess in order to get her the necessary humidity exposure that would get her both mentally and physically prepped for the Tokyo heat and humidity.
So, Bridget, what is the plan then if you have a runner who is maybe not used to the humidity or maybe not used to the heat and is going to participate in a competition in a place that has one or both of those? I assume you don't just like blast up the thermostat initially and have them run for a while. Like, how do you try to acclimate the body to those things?
It really depends on where they live and where they're going to be competing in. So we had actually 4 of the 6 marathoners that qualified for Tokyo for Team USA were Brooks athletes. And so we had similar strategies for all of them, but they all live in different parts of the country. So each of their strategies looked different based off of where they lived. Some people had to use a heat chamber at other universities. Some people just lived in high heat, high humid areas like in the East Coast. But there are other ways that if just say they don't have access to a heat chamber or they don't live in somewhere that's hot or humid, you can do other types of acclimation, like hot tub, sauna sessions. I would say they're not as impactful as actually exercising in those conditions, but they can get you some exposure to prepare an athlete for the physiological strain of heat and humidity.
So Ellie, I know that anybody who has spent time, you know, in Florida or on the East Coast in the summer, DC, like they understand the difference between the kind of heat that you get in Arizona and, you know, the kind of heat that also comes with humidity. But when you are an elite athlete, what is the difference between, you know, when you have to perform in that, maybe not quite being acclimated to one or the other or both?
Yeah. So, I mean, if like you were saying out in Florida, you can feel that humidity on you, right? It's a little sticky. Mm-hmm. Your hair maybe gets a little frizzy. And so that's, if you think of that in an exercise for these elite athletes, especially for Jess, right? She has the heat on her side being from Phoenix. Going into that chamber, we had it around 70%, built her up to 80% relative humidity. So it's very damp. It's very heavy. With elite athletes, we want to, one, consider safety. So make sure that they're able to, you know, change their sweat rate and adapt to that humidity to better handle that high heat. And then that just goes, it's a long marathon. So being able to maintain pace, make sure you're fueling properly, you're feeling good in it. It feels very different when you're used to running outside in a drier temperature. So a lot more sweat, it feels heavier, a little more tight. And so it gives an edge up being able to, one, mentally get used to that feeling, but then also making sure they're safe, their body's able to respond to those heat changes, and we're able to maximize their performance.
I'll just add into that. When athletes are prepared for the humidity, so when these elite marathoners are training dry heat versus, I'll call it wet heat, sweat doesn't evaporate as easily in humid conditions. Mm-hmm. And so these athletes need to get their bodies used to competing and training in the humid conditions, because that leads to an earlier onset of sweating, which allows them to start cooling themselves easier. It can possibly increase their sweating rate. And it makes it more effective for them to, or it makes a more effective heat loss for them once they get used to that humidity, because their body then adapts to that and knows, hey, I'm working harder in the heat, so now I need to work more to cool myself, because the evaporative cooling isn't going to be as efficient as it normally is in dry heat.
Well, yeah, Bridget, I wanted to ask you about that, because I wonder if maybe having that exposure to being in a hot, humid environment, even if it's not sort of in the world, like, does that maybe change how an athlete prepares for a race? Maybe, you know, what they eat or drink beforehand, or maybe even how much, you know, water or hydration they take along the route, given, you know, changes in the climate from what they're used to?
Absolutely. So sweating rate and therefore sweat sodium concentration is definitely impacted by environmental conditions, exercise intensity and duration, and all of those factors. So if, for instance, we sweat tested Jess in the Tokyo-like conditions in the heat chamber with Ellie, she led that sweat testing. And that allowed us to see what Jess's sweat rate and sodium rate of loss was in Tokyo conditions. If we would have tested her a month or two before that, her needs may have been different, because at that time she wasn't as heat acclimated or prepared for the humidity, which increases the sweating rate and therefore changes the needs for sodium and fluid needs as well during the race.
And Ellie, am I right that this is the highest you've ever bumped up the humidity for an experiment like this?
Yep, at our chamber it is. So, and that was what was exciting about this opportunity and getting to work with Jess and Bridget. It's been used for research up until Jess kind of hopped in there. So it was high humidity, but not 80%, probably more around like a 40 to 60% relative humidity is what a lot of the research was happening at. So getting Jess in there, it was kind of an experiment in its own of seeing how our chamber would adapt, seeing what that really felt like in a smaller room. And yeah, it did it well. It handled it great. Jess handled it great. We were definitely a little, you know, sticky. It was damp in there, but it was really cool. It was an awesome time to use that and kind of push that limit a bit.
So, Bridget, obviously, as you've discussed, there's a physiological benefit to having a runner train in the environment that they're going to be competing in. I wonder if there's also sort of a psychological benefit that, you know, in this case, Jess knew that sort of what she was getting herself into, what it was going to feel like when she got to Tokyo. And maybe that helped with the psychological training as well.
100%. I think that was a major factor. I think it's arguably as important as the psychological component of it. When you're getting off that plane and you're getting into Tokyo, that humidity just hits you and it's hard to breathe if you're not used to it. And so that I had spoken to her before and after the race, and she said that she's like, it didn't faze me. You know, I knew what to expect. I knew mentally what to expect breathing and just how I would feel. And so that alone is a really big, that gives her a really big advantage to some others that might not have prepared as much in that humid conditions, like working on your breathing. You also might not want to eat and drink as much as you normally do, but you have to train your body to be more comfortable in that. So that can impact every part of your strategy throughout the race. And that clearly like didn't faze her very much.
All right. Well, Bridget, Ellie, thanks to you both for the conversation. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank
this
you so
great.
Much.
Bridget Sopena is principal exercise physiologist at Brooks Running. Ellie Iwersen is a clinical exercise physiologist at ASU. Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. President Trump earlier this year signed an executive order requiring commercial truck drivers to be able to pass an English proficiency test. That reversed guidance from the Obama administration that allowed drivers to use technology like translation apps to communicate. Between the beginning of June and mid-October, the U.S. Transportation Department says 345 commercial drivers in Arizona failed the English proficiency test and had been pulled off the road. That was the fourth most in the country behind Texas, Wyoming, and Tennessee. With me to talk more about this is Tony Bradley, President and CEO of the Arizona Trucking Association. Tony, good morning. Welcome.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing all right. So can you sort of explain what does this English proficiency test entail?
Yeah, I think first and foremost, it's good to clarify that there's a difference between English language proficiency and English fluency. What proficiency is meant to cover is that when a driver's out on the road, they are often stopped and asked about their load or given a safety inspection. And so that driver needs to be able to clearly communicate or understand the instructions given by law enforcement as their rig is being inspected. A great example under the previous guidance memo, when an officer would say to touch their brakes in order to inspect the brakes, the driver may not have known that that's what they were instructing them to do. And so oftentimes they were let go without doing that full inspection. So what this new reversal does is say if the driver needs to be proficient in English, that way we can do the safety inspection.
When do these checks tend to happen along a route?
So they happen at what everybody would think is a port of entry. So when you enter a new state, there are ports of entry where drivers pull over and can go through a variety of different checks, whether it just be paperwork or whether their equipment's being checked. Or also it can happen at roadside. So a truck's driving down the road, they can be pulled over for any reason to have a safety inspection, and they can happen there as well.
And it sounds like, as you're saying, there's the difference between proficiency and fluency. Like a driver doesn't necessarily need to know how to order a meal at a restaurant. They need to know the words that relate specifically to the vehicle they're driving and the load that they're carrying. Is that right?
That is correct. It's the load that they're carrying, the vehicle that they're driving, the instructions, the road signs that are out on the road. The dynamic signs, for instance, if there's a detour, those are all safety related issues. And so they have to be proficient in the school, in the trade, in the terms of the trade. And so those are what that includes. Again, it doesn't mean, yes, like you said, understanding a paragraph in a book, it's related to safety. It's related to trucking. It's related to their load, where they're coming from, where they're going. And then again, the equipment that they're driving.
Will drivers generally be asked the same questions? And I'm asking because there's been some concern about these tests being maybe a little subjective and leaving a lot of discretion up to the inspector about whether or not the driver actually understands what they're being asked or not.
There, unfortunately, there is a level of subjectivity, and that disparity can happen from state to state, officer to officer. I believe the states work to train their officers to their standards, but they are, but while they are subjective, there are certain standards. For instance, a driver can be pulled over, and the first question is, do you speak English? If they say no, then they're going to be subjected to the test. If they say yes, then they will continue to move forward until the officer determines that they're not able to administer their safety inspection, at which point they may be administered the English language proficiency test, which has a variety of road signs. I don't know the exact amount, but let's say 30 signs. Mm-hmm. They have to, the officer will pick six or so out of there and then determine whether or not that driver understands what those road signs are.
So there has been some conversation after President Trump signed this executive order earlier this year that it was in some way related to his immigration crackdown and his deportation program. Is that your understanding of what's going on here?
I think there's certainly an interpretation that that's why it happened. But I can tell you since the guidance memo during the Obama administration, my conversations with law enforcement have been very concerning because there's drivers all throughout this country that don't speak English. Again, if you're under that truck and you're telling the driver to touch their brakes, they need to be able to understand that. And with the translation app, that simply wasn't satisfying the requirements of those safety inspections. So again, those drivers were often let to go down the road without their equipment being inspected. So it was a concern from industry. The English language proficiency requirement has been in existence since we've had commercial trucking. So that you know, while probably well-intended, it just didn't work in reality.
Are you finding that there are trucking companies in Arizona that are specifically trying to train their drivers, maybe especially those who are not native English speakers or aren't fluent in English, to at least understand the words that they need to know, the concepts they need to know to safely do this job and to pass the inspections?
I would say yes, that is a fair assessment. Again, the English language proficiency never went away, that requirement. Trucking companies try and train their drivers to make sure that they understand the rules of the road, they can read those road signs, and that they can, you know, safely deliver those loads. You know, my members are very concerned about everybody getting home safe on the road, and English language proficiency is a part of that. If a driver happens to get what we call an out-of-service order because a law enforcement officer said that they aren't proficient in the language, they've got programs. Many of them have programs to try and teach them what those words are.
Tony, before I let you go, I'm curious about the effect of this number of drivers being taken off the road. I mean, trucking is not one of those industries in Arizona that has had a surplus of drivers. So, like, is there a concern about supply chains and companies being able to fulfill their orders?
You know, first and foremost, we're always concerned about safety. And so that's going to be at the top of mind for everybody. You know, if a driver's taken off a road because of English language proficiency, many companies are going to either try and rehabilitate that driver and teach them the language, or they're going to exit the industry. Right now, we're at the end of a three-year freight recession. So we do have more capacity than is needed because people simply aren't buying as much stuff as they were post-pandemic.
Interesting. All right. That is Tony Bradley, President and CEO of the Arizona Trucking Association. Tony, thank you. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Have a good day.
There are lots of things we're used to seeing in competition. Sports, of course, car racing, now baking. But what about massage? Well, it turns out professional massage therapists all over the country are holding championships these days. And our next guest started it all right here in Phoenix. John Sanders is a massage instructor as well as the owner of his own massage practice, Mind, Body, and Balance Massage by John. And he's the director of the annual Arizona Massage Championship and Showcase. This year will be their fifth competition, held this weekend at the Southwest Institute of Healing Arts. My co-host Lauren Gilger spoke with Sanders more about it and where the idea for a massage championship began.
In my old school, Arizona School of Massage Therapy, we, meaning the instructors, would treat our students to demonstrations where there was no script. We would just do what we do, and the students oohed and aahed on what they saw. And then it later progressed into bringing some of our advanced students to demonstrate. And then it led to us inviting some of the spas, the local spas, to have a representative come in and show what they do. And it became a big deal for our students. Our students loved it. Our day students, night students, they really looked forward to it.
So students really liked watching someone else give the massage. And this is because it sounds like there are many more ways to do a massage than we might assume.
Oh, yeah. When I came into the industry, there was 171 different modalities. There's close to 400 now. There's
wow.
So many different techniques. And so when you do a championship, there's no telling what you're going to see. And and people will combine different techniques and modalities and make it look like something brand new. So it's awesome.
That's really cool. What kinds of techniques, what kinds of modalities? Like I know about, you know, hot stone massages and Swedish massages, but what else is there out there?
Well, there is Thai massage. And, you know, right now in our cities all across the United States, the stretch industry is huge. So when you combine Swedish with deep tissue, hot stone, and stretch therapies, you have something that's very unique, and it caters to the people that want a nice, relaxing massage, as well as those that really want to feel their massage.
Yeah, yeah. Some people definitely do.
Yes.
Okay, so you go from demonstrations with your students to launching the first kind of competition, like a championship in terms of massage in the state.
The current school I work at now, Southwest Institute of Healing Arts in Tempe, I was invited to a meeting. And the owner, Casey Miller, said, does anybody have any ideas how to promote our massage program? And right away, without even thinking, I said, let's do a massage championship. She stared at me for a second and said, okay, do it. And we did it. I put out some advertisement. We had a group of therapists come in and actually went very well. I mean, it was scaled back compared to what it is now, but it was awesome. And we've been doing it ever since.
Okay, so let's talk about what a massage championship looks like, because this is not something we think about as like a competition, a competitive sport at all, right?
Right.
How does this work? Like, what are the categories to begin with?
So if you go to other championships that exist now, man, they have Swedish categories, facial categories, sports categories, chair massage category. They have Thai massage categories. Here in Arizona, we basically have a clothed category and an unclothed category. Huh. The unclothed is basically your typical Swedish massage, getting under the sheet and with draping. The clothed modality, you will see a lot more stretching, and you know people are wearing clothes, but we're still manipulating their muscles, and it's massage.
That's interesting. Okay, so that's the categories. What about how you judge something like this?
So we judge on a few things. One is your technique. Are you utilizing the basic hand positions, effrage, petrissage, compression, friction, vibration? Then we judge on flow. And flow is the connectivity as you move from one body part to another. Some therapists struggle with flow. They're sort of choppy. They're here to here. But the really talented massage therapists, it almost looks like they're in a dance, a coordinated dance.
Huh.
And that flow is important. Then the other is ergonomics, which is basically your body mechanics, how you move through and around the table or on the mat, and which is one of the main reasons I got into massage, because If you don't have really good body mechanics, you can still give a really good massage, but you, the therapist, you're going to hurt.
Interesting.
It's going to hurt your neck, your shoulders, your back. But when you learn the flow and the technique of really good transition, it almost looks like you're dancing with your client, and there's something that happens during a massage championship. There's this energy in the room when everyone's doing their own thing all together. It is palpable. You can feel it, and it sometimes makes people emotional. And especially when you watch a really talented massage therapist glide and sort of dance with their client. It's a feeling that you don't ever get in a classroom. It's a feeling that I never felt until we did our massage championship.
That's fascinating. Okay, so you've got a room full of, is it table after table after table?
Table after table after table.
Okay, and I'm sure music, et cetera, mm-hmm. judges walking throughout?
Judges walking around with their little clipboard. They go with the IMA, which is the International Massage Association scorecard.
Okay.
And if they see something they like, judges will give them a notch up. If they see something they don't like, give them a notch down.
Yeah.
They get together, formulate their scores, and boom. We have a winner.
My goodness. Okay, so this has really taken off across the country since you started this here in Arizona,
yes,
right?
Yes, yes. And you know what? It was never my intention. My intention was just to do it for Southwest Institute of Healing Arts and to promote massage there. But the Europeans have been doing massage championships for a number of years,
yeah.
all across Europe, Canada, Mexico. I've got friends that compete in Norway, Romania.
So, yeah, like describe what this looks like for us. I mean, what's the kind of the coolest thing you've ever seen someone do in a really great massage in one of these competitions?
Oh, man. You know, one of the categories is innovation.
Okay.
And with innovation, some people use tools. You've heard of cupping, right?
Yep.
You've heard of bamboo sticks.
Uh-huh.
Hot stones.
Sure.
Well, some of the tools that people have created are just out of this world. Hula hoops. Battery operated thing is in every championship every year, someone comes out with a new tool. Sometimes people use fire. We don't allow fire in our
sometimes
things.
People use fire.
In their cups, they put flames in their fire. And,
wow.
Yeah,
okay, okay.
It's very different, but the tools and the innovation is very interesting. It's not for everyone. Sometimes you'll see things that you won't see at a normal spa.
Yeah. So you've got almost a show aspect to some of this, it sounds like.
Very much so. Very much. You know, if you're a client, wonder what's out there.
Right.
You need to come to a massage championship because you're going to see so many different things.
So I wonder this, John, just talking to you about the world of massage and how vast it is and how kind of technical and professional it can be. Mm-hmm. Like, do you think we're thinking about massage all wrong in this country? Like, is it more of an art to you? Is it a service? Is it a sport?
I say massage is an art, especially when you do it beautifully with perfect body mechanics. You're innovative, mixing all the different modalities. I've heard many massage therapists considering what they do art.
All right. Well, looking forward to it. John Sanders, he is a massage instructor, owner of Mind, Body, and Balance Massage by John, and director of the annual Massage Championship and Showcase, which is coming up on November 1st. John, thank you so much for coming
in.
I really appreciate
it. All right. Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. Halloween is, of course, on Friday, which means lots of people are either putting the finishing touches on their costumes or getting excited to see how others respond to them when they see them. And as always, some partygoers will be donning costumes that are inspired by recent headlines. With me to talk about what's popular this year and why some of us decide to dress up as the news is Amanda Kerberg, a PhD student at ASU's Walter Cronkite School and a resident pop culture expert. Amanda, good morning.
Good morning.
So what's trendy in terms of like newsy Halloween costumes this year?
Oh my gosh. Just in the last couple of weeks now, we have the Louvre jewelry thieves
yeah.
entering the fray. Very easy costume. Just kind of get a little construction vest and some costume jewelry. You're good to go. I think couples costume, the Coldplay kiss cam, Travis Kelce and Taylor Swift.
Naturally.
Multiple versions. Inflatables will continue to be big because everybody has them from going to protests. I think we'll probably see some Labubus, some Lafufus. Katy Perry in space, Aunt Gladys from Weapons, so many options this year.
Why is it so appealing to people to dress up as like people in current events?
You know, I think I would put my nerd cap on and say that one of the ways that we build community in postmodernity is by understanding references. So like our media, you know, is this crazy mix right now of low culture, high culture, news, pop culture, media, like everything, right? And so partly we get this like warm, fuzzy feeling when we understand a reference.
Like, and we're in on the joke.
Yeah,
kind of
yeah, it is. So it's like everything becomes a potential in-joke. Everything becomes an opportunity to feel belonging to this sense of time and place. And we saw that, you know, with the rise of super referential shows like Family Guy, you know, South Park, mm-hmm. like, right? Like all of these things that just yeah. speak to this embeddedness that we all have every day in an information and cultural overload. Yeah.
Well, so like how do people try to navigate that? Because as we know, you know, media is so fractured and,
yeah.
you know, a YouTube channel that gets hundreds of thousands of views might be totally foreign to somebody else. So like how do you like what is something that we're all connected to? Like, I think
yeah.
most people know about the Louvre heist. And if you're yes. dressed as that, like that's something that was in the news. But like if you're referring to, you know, a character on a show or, you know, in a YouTube video or on some meme somewhere, like I would imagine there's some number of people who just aren't going to get it.
Oh, absolutely. In that sense, I think maybe that can be helpful at a Halloween party, especially where you're meeting a lot of new people. Because if, hey, you know what? We're all tired of talking about what we do as a job. So if you want to talk about what is your hyperfixation from your corner of the internet, from the community in which, yeah, your media fragmented self ends up enjoying so much of your time, that's a great thing to talk about. I mean, I'll mention my costume this year.
Yeah,
is a little, it's not really niche, but it might be at parties I'm going to. I'm going as essentially an unofficial mascot of the Vanderbilt football team
okay.
that is coming. It's out of the YouTube channel SEC Shorts. And they do really, really great comedy about the Southeastern Football Conference. And it's so fun. It's what I look forward to every Monday morning. Nick Saban, former, you know, GOAT football coach of Alabama, just wore this costume on College Game Day. But yeah, I will be explaining this a lot.
Right. Well, so this brings up the balance that seems to happen. Because, like, I would think if I saw you at a Halloween party, I would think that's a really cool costume, Amanda. But I would have no idea what the reference was.
Yeah.
So, like, what's the balance between, like, not spending your entire time at a party explaining what your costume is?
That's a good question. I think that's an important thing to think through. But at the same time, it's like, you know, the rhetorical world of the internet and digital culture is so much about being clever, being witty, being funny, right? Like we all speak in humor now, mm-hmm. from corporations to politics. So it's like the internet reframes everything into binary and into humor. So I think even if your costume is something that you have to explain, once people get it or you know, it means something to you that you came up with it and it's
yeah.
funny and it's clever and it's got layers. You know, I say go for it.
Well, it kind of sounds like it's a way to like introduce yourself maybe to people
yeah.
you don't know. Like, hey, this is based on my costume. This is something that I find interesting or something that I find funny or something I find ironic.
I think that's a really good point, because if you think about like kind of the classic Halloween costumes, if you're showing up as a witch, a ghost, you know, a ghoul. Like, that's not really saying anything about you, right? That's
other
kind of
than
just
that you don't have a whole lot of creativity yeah. these days, right?
Yeah.
If you're above a certain age, like kids are great. But
yeah.
as an adult, like, I don't go to Halloween parties a ton, but mm-hmm. I don't see a lot of grown-ups dressed up as ghosts.
No, right? The ones who are dressed as ghosts are the ones who ghosted the party and are at home. But yeah, no, I think it's a great way to get to introduce ourselves and say, like, this is something that's meaningful to me. In a way, it's like, you know, we're all doing that all the time now, right? We all have to find ways to curate some introduction to ourselves, whether it's in a one-line bio on Instagram or our profile on Facebook or Blue Sky, you know, whatever mm-hmm. it is, right? So in that way, we've turned costumes into that, too. It's like, here's something about who I am. Here's something, you know, about my tastes, my preferences, my joys, my obsessions. Yeah.
I mean, so what went into your thinking of going as the unofficial Vanderbilt mascot? What are you trying to get across to people that you maybe don't know?
You know, I think a lot of people don't know how obsessed I am with college football. So I think
okay.
that'll be a fun thing to get to talk about.
That won't be a secret yeah. after Friday, will it?
No. And also, I was really, really thinking pragmatically, comfort-wise.
Mm.
And what do I already own? I was like, I can already go as a Vanderbilt fan very easily.
Okay.
And if I just add, you know, a crown, a cape, and a king's staff, I'm pretty much good to go. I got to get some wraparound sunglasses sometime. I'll stop at Walgreens. We'll call it a day.
So, like, do you have a sense? Like, do you have – I assume you have friends who are also dressing up and going to parties. Are they also dressing up as sort of current events?
Yes. Yeah. One of my friends is going to be a French press this year, which is – I don't know how she's going to execute
like,
this.
Is she a big coffee fan?
But she is French. Yeah. Okay. And you know what? Last year I saw a lot of Olympics viral moments at Halloween parties. Yeah.
Interesting.
Which was a lot of fun.
Yeah. All right. We'll have to wait for next year for the Winter Olympics.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
A lot of people showing up as snowboarders or
it's
alpine
gonna be
skiers or something.
It's terrible for us in Arizona. Sometimes it's over 100 still here.
Bring your own snow. All right. That is Amanda Kareberg, a PhD student at ASU's Walter Cronkite School. Amanda, good as always to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you. Happy Halloween.
And to you. And that'll do it for today's edition of the show. Thanks, as always, for being along. Remember, you can sign up for the show's weekly newsletter at theshow.kjzz.org. It is called Radio Heads. You can also follow us on Instagram. We are at KJZZ The Show. Maybe, I don't know, post photos of your really cool referential Halloween costumes there. For Lauren Gilger and Sam Dingman, I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. Have a terrific rest of your day. Hope to have you right back here tomorrow. That's it for this episode of The Show podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.